Welcome to the RCGP Innovation Podcast, produced by the Clinical Innovation and Research Centre at the RCGP. We're here to support you to be innovative in general practice in primary care, including digital health, data, emerging technologies, how we deliver care through networks, how we deliver care around the person, and being entrepreneurial at the front line. We hope to use this podcast to bring you updates on a rapidly changing landscape, new discussions, introduce you to new people, their challenges and their successes. If you're interested in this space, please subscribe through your podcast platform. This is the second of our two-part podcast. In this podcast, you will hear a panel discussion involving Ruth Chambers, Sandeep Bansal and Neha Tanna, chaired by Shani Patel. And they will be discussing emerging digital innovations in primary care, how they shape practice, improving care for patients, and the ethical dilemmas to ensure safe and cost-effective use of tools.
So we have Neha, Sandeep and Ruth, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves, what they do, and what they've brought to the Innovation Mentorship Programme. Why don't you kick off?
I've been a GP for more than 40 years, just stopped, and worked in NHS management. So my main thing has been about trying to get innovation at scale across general practices. So at the moment it's digital primary care transformation. And to do that, I've had to bring in loads and loads of money. And so that means then I can incentivise practices and point out to them where they need to improve and where technology can help them. So try and finding all those kind of ways to do adoption of innovation at scale in the real world and not just a lot of tech pretense.
So I'm Sandeep. I was a GP trainee. Didn't qualify as a GP, but I founded my own company called Medic Creations. So we're making an instant communication solution across the entire SDP. So you may have seen the pager purge news in February. We are responsible partially, sorry. But our aim is to make that communication process from social care right the way through to secondary care much more smooth, you know, because that's the biggest gaps that I saw having practiced in clinical medicine. I also obviously am a mentor on the innovation program, and I also mentor at Harvard Med School to a surgical leadership program over there.
I'm nowhere near as accomplished as these two. I trained as a GP. I took a kind of a breakout and I went and worked for the pharmaceutical industry for about seven years. And that's kind of where I fell in love with innovation and actually having stepped outside of the NHS realised how much there is to learn from outside and bring it back in. So then went and joined a startup, which was in segmentation imaging, and learned the hard way, like these guys, about how damn hard it is. But we got lucky and we exited last summer. So since then, I have been working with IMP, RCGP IMP, other incubators, mentorships, and have now landed myself in healthcare investment, where I'm driving a thought process of investing in clinicians who actually bring a heck of a lot. So all of you in this room, you know, partnering up with the right people, it's not just about the business people and the entrepreneurs, it's all of you. This room alone is worth so much, and so I'm trying to push the thought process about putting money behind the people like ourselves who can then drive innovation.
So I'm going to jump straight into something controversial because I'm conscious of time. I don't know how many of you are aware of the scandals that have entered the healthcare technology space with the company Theranos that had a lot of, I think she's probably going to jail now. But anyway, moving to the lessons from that, how important is evaluation and evidence with innovations? Because that's something that Helen Stokes Lampard mentioned this morning. You know, how good have we been at looking at evaluation and evidence before launching innovations or technologies at scale?
Well, I'm just going to give a personal answer, and that is whatever I do, because I've said that I can only work by bringing in external funds. By that I mean NHSE usually. And I calculated, I was sitting over there, brought in $1.5 million for what I'm talking about now over the last sort of 18 months. Then there's no point me getting that money unless I can show them that it was worthwhile, and therefore they'll give me more. And so I don't do research anymore, because that takes 10 years. I do service evaluation of service redesign. And whatever I do, I'm only doing it in a way that can be sustainable for the NHS. So therefore, I do actually avoid commercial companies unless there's some reason not to. And then I'm going with easily accessible, easily trustworthy apps, social media, video consultation, whatever, and trying to work out the obstacles. So then my evaluation's more about how people overcome obstacles, and knowing that I've got to appeal to the people who are giving me the money, how do I increase productivity, general practice, how do I improve patient outcomes, that's both patients and clinicians, how do I improve patient convenience, etc. So I am very, and then I also publish it wherever people want. So over the last year, I think I've made about 8 publications. Often I'm using medical students to do the evaluation because they're nice and cheap. And it also gets their names on their CVs, they get publications. And because I've done those publications, people write to me all over the world, will I present? And then the other day, just as a joke, I said to the team, well, shall we present in Miami? So now 5 of us are going to present in Miami in October.
Oh, wow.
Using my external funding to pay for our transport and our...
So I think you're quite right, Shani. You know, Taranis is a key example, and we see examples all over, to be honest, on social media, where evaluation hasn't been put at the forefront of the tech. And being clinicians, I think we're much more understanding of that. Mm. We wouldn't prescribe drugs until there was clear evidence base behind it, with, you know, pros, benefits, and also side effects. And much like that, I think technology needs to be driven through benefit evaluation. And only scaled at that point. But that's really difficult when you're possibly VC-backed, you know, and that's where the conflicts arise. I've been fortunate enough not to be VC-backed, but personally invested. So I've managed to get to that point where we've published peer review papers to show, you know, we're saving 21 minutes for every single nurse, every single shift, and 48 minutes for every single junior doctor. But that was 4 years of pain to get to that point. So which VC will back you on? Hoping
Yeah, so actually it's a really, really good point. So I think Theranos is one in like a billion, okay? I mean, it doesn't happen in every country or in every continent. However, I do think it was a signal to the health of that industry. I think that if you think about where we are right now from a diversity point of view, I think if you think historically, the kind of people that were making investments were ex-bankers. They've never worked in healthcare. They don't know. They just had a lot of money that they wanted to put behind stuff. There were people who had done big exits of their own companies and were like, I want to give back. What's the easiest way to give back? And for some reason, the low-hanging fruit was healthcare. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of people that have put money behind healthcare companies. So to ensure that you've got a good evaluation, there's now a concept of smart money. And so if anyone is sort of starting their own company or they're wanting to get funding, go to an investor that actually has good people on their evaluation board, people who either come from a medical background, people who've worked in this space, or people who've exited another healthcare company. Don't go to an angel group, or even a VC group, or a PE group who have just got bankers on their board, because they're only gonna push you to increase your balance sheet and the base of it. And I think evaluation is key, and I think people in this room, this is where they can add value. You can all participate by helping evaluate. So in your day job, when you're out and about meeting companies, offer your services. There is a lot of pro bono work in this space. I get it, and it's hard. No one wants to do anything for free. But if you actually want to make a change, you have to kind of be like, well, actually, I come from a medical background. I can help you. Let me help you show how we can do this a bit better. And it, as with anything, changing a culture or changing a thought process takes time, effort, sweat, tears. But to the point now where, you know, all of us can have a say in companies, whether you sit on an advisory board, whether you're working with young companies, small companies, I'd say just raise your voice. Like, you know, we've been quiet for so long. And it's up to us to kind of go in and say, well, actually, it's fine, put money behind it, but your science is rubbish. So yeah, I'd say it's up to us to kind of push that change a little bit.
I'll just add one more thing, that recently I've got very friendly with Facebook headquarters, and this again goes back to the contacts and things that you were talking about before, and tried it on with Facebook in California with a connection from London, and now they're giving me £40,000 worth, really, of their venue in London for a conference in 2 weeks' time. And that's because they said to me, we haven't got any money, Ruth. I said, well, how about equivalent resource? And I'm just trying it on at the moment with Wetherspoons. And out of the blue, I've written to their chief executive, Tim Martin. And within 12 hours, I've got somebody senior who we're now going to have a meet-up. And I'm not quite sure what I want out of them. It will be something about social isolation and technology and so on. And so is what was that you're using your credibility as a medic to go to people, and you're better to go high up like that and not ask directly for money, but in your mind you're thinking equivalent resource.
So bringing these, whether it's service redesign or new innovations, back to primary care, why has it been so difficult to innovate in primary care when GPs by nature are adaptable, responsive, passionate? Why has it been so difficult? Why does it feel like we are still 10 years behind everyone else?
I used to think what you just said then about GPs, but now I'm afraid I go directly to practice nurses because they're the ones that I'm actually mainly focusing on. So what is it you need? You're being blocked by your practice. Once they've got a nurse doing stuff with technology, and maybe we've had to give them a tablet, which is why I need the external funding, and put the apps on it for them and show them what to do and upskill them, they're then champions in their practice team. And if it does, they can show it's reducing the video consultations, stopping so many care home visits or whatever it is. The GPs then come along. So actually at the moment, I'm kind of cheating, mainly in going to the nurse to lead the practice team. There are a few GPs, but they tend to be a bit more like Tico and do really amazing things over here rather than the day-to-day improving productivity and using technology.
I think there's some really good examples of innovation that's scaled in the GP world. And Shani, you're a great example of that. My COPD, they seem to be doing a great job, and they're in a lot of CCGs. But traditionally, why is it hard? Because it's not just down to the GPs. There's a lot of stakeholders involved. Procurement challenges are a struggle. You know, we know how difficult that process is. The benefit of realization initially for innovators to show, and there's not many innovators that truly understand that or can hold enough finances to be able to get to that point. And then they break down, you know, through the bureaucracy. But that's the grand reality of it. And I think that's why it's so tough. But also user adoption. You know, what I've seen tech companies do really well is cater towards one of the stakeholders really, really well.
Yeah.
You'll either cater towards the patient experience really slickly, but then forget, how does that fit into the clinician's workflow? The interoperability issues, which I know NHSX and England are now working on, thankfully, you know, they're looking at open APIs, you know, rather than building up the NHS app, which is a huge relief. But those are the challenges that I've seen in the primary care sector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think what Sandeep has already said, but also healthcare is riskier,
yeah.
Right? It's not a Facebook, it's not a WhatsApp. There's so much risk associated with it that, one, people are a bit scared to try new things, and two, yes, money isn't thrown at it like it's thrown at big tech companies like Google and all the others, like the Ubers and all the others that are coming up. But also, I think it comes down to people. I think GPs are great, but they're overworked, they don't have time. And actually, I think if you want to start a business or join a business, look at the people in it. I would say, maybe slightly controversial, don't partner up with people who are in your practice, right? But you've got GPs, maybe two people, that's fine, but bring in somebody who's got commercial experience, bring in somebody who's got business growth or growth hacking experience, or whatever it is, or whatever your product is. Bring people from the outside in, because you will learn a heck of a lot from them. I mean, my startup, and I was quick segue in 30 seconds, it was an AI imaging startup. What the hell do I know about like AI imaging? I had nothing, I didn't know anything. But what I did know was healthcare, and I knew the system. The other three wrote the code. One was ex-Tesla, one of the other guys was a growth hacker. You know, it's the team that can make it happen. And I think, I think primary care, we haven't had time. We haven't had that environment. I think it was you were saying that you haven't had that environment to encourage it, but maybe we make time for ourselves. And if everyone is to kind of manage their time that way and then bring in people from outside, I think we could probably catch up, because healthcare is riskier, but we have all the skills to make it happen. We just need to kind of push it, I think.
So So what I'm hearing from you three is that we need local leadership, whether it's servant leadership or, I mean, I'm not a fan of traditional hierarchical leadership, but nevertheless, some structures are set up that way. Also hearing more empowerment with funding, and I think primary care networks are certainly bringing that. The funding is, well, the layers that one has to go through to procure, that's all changing. I think there is going to be a lot more local decision making and people probably experimenting more because they have the ability to spend and not have to go through 9 months to get something signed off. So yeah, I think PCNs having digital champions or tech champions will certainly be good at being innovation sites. If any of you know anybody or any of you are interested, please speak to Pritesh Mistry over there, the head of the Innovation Mentorship Program, because there are innovations who are looking for test sites. And you could be partnering up with a company that has the potential to transform population health and do something really, really imaginative. Got 5 minutes left. Any questions for our esteemed panel? Yes, introduce yourself first.
Hi, good morning. My name is Waka Shah, and I'm a GP in Wandsworth. And thank you very much for the panel, this one and before, for all the great stuff you do. Thank you very much. So we've talked about helping patients and making patients' lives easier and making patient care better. Can I turn the table around to us? And what about me? What about us? How can we make our lives better? And I know that 5G is on the horizon. And what I wanted to ask you as a panel is, I want you to do something for me. So I'm an appraiser. I enjoy my work as an appraiser. But when it comes to my own appraisal, I'm very much a last minute guy. I would love technology to be able to pick up that I've been here at this conference, and it would automatically log that I've spent 6 hours here at the RCGP, and when my certificate of attendance comes through by email, I want AI to pick that up, put it in my portfolio, so all I have to do is just reflect. And I want AI to be able to, in consultation, when I've seen someone with, say, joint pain, multi-joint pain affecting the hands and feet, and I make a routine rheumatology referral, I want to pop up to say, Waka, listen, you made a routine referral, would you want to consider an urgent referral just in case this patient needs DMARD treatment? So I'd like that sort of technology, AI-backed technology, to help me in my work and make my life easier for me so that I don't spend 2 weekends before my appraisal working my ass off trying to get it all down. I want all that to be self-populated, so all I have to do is reflect. And I want to be safer in my practice as a GP, and I want those real-time pop-ups to come up and alert me to other ways of doing things which will make me safer and actually ultimately improve patient care. So can anyone do that for me?
It actually exists, by the way. It's coming. Can I quickly take that?
Well, I think it's open to more than one of you, because Duncan, you might have to talk to us with me.
The first one, you just need a really good PA. I mean, I'm the same in my own appraisal, like do it 2-4. But so just to your point of AI, to your first point about, I don't know how to answer this. Data is the issue. Okay, there are so many AI algorithms out there that are looking at picking up errors in medical imaging, picking up cancer cells in a mold that you could look at in your GP surgery, picking up, you know, the stethoscopes that are listening to chest to see if there's pneumonia. All of that, it exists, it's out there, but there's not enough data to push it in. So actually another responsibility that perhaps we can take upon ourselves to make our lives a bit easier is engage with some of these commercial entities, and if we can, open up our data to them. Because the more data that these algorithms have, the more accurate they are. The more accurate they are, the more money they'll get. The more money they'll get, the quicker it will land in your hand. So it's not an easy fix. It exists. There's just too much regulation around it, but we can change it.
I think that hearing you speak, poor chap, you're obviously not using 14 fish.
Spend your life and really wouldn't be.
So I think with the notification stuff, actually, it's really interesting. That's one of the biggest challenges that we're working on, because communication to me is not about human to human, but it's actually machine to human, human to machine, and machine to machine as well, you know, down the development pathway. And we're really cognizant of over-notification, so not bombarding you guys. You know, I was so frustrated with all the EPR systems out there that keep giving me alerts and pop-ups, you know, and the vision system's giving me alert after alert. I'm just like, please stop, you know, and that is really draining on our cognitive abilities to practice efficiently. So what we're really working with, actually, how do we stop those alerts from coming to you until the right moment, yeah? And that's the biggest challenge that we're really working on, and that requires a lot of data, yeah? Requires a lot of AI, but again, it needs that data to come together. That's one of the biggest challenges as an ASA. Then we're working with a company called Suki. They do this voice-enabled stuff. So you go, hey, Suki, you know, listen up. And it will listen to the patient because it knows you're the clinician, it knows your voice, but it knows when you say, hey, listen, that's the patient. And it records what the patient's saying at that point. So we are doing this kind of stuff. Yeah? But it's just getting it through the right channels in the NHS as well.
And my side of it is more the governance stuff. So I've written a code of technology-enabled care services code of practice for our digital workstream in Staffordshire, which needs updating again. It's already got 25 elements, and I need to put a few more in for them. Not as I'm an expert in it, but in a way, not being an expert, I spot things more. So particularly things like clinical indemnity, I'm just doing a small project at the moment with Alexa and Amazon Echo Shows, but I've kept it away from getting clinicians to identify the patient for me, because I know it's going to bring in more governance ramifications. So I'm just proving the system with protocols through voluntary groups and so on. So you've got to have all that other side going on at the same time to make sure you've got all the governance and data security and privacy and everything else in the world, and clinical indemnity is a big part of that too.
Yeah, I'd definitely echo that. I think using technology to minimise risks in certain things may open up exposure to others, and companies that are co-designing with indemnity companies often mitigate for those. But that takes time, and I think, Sandeep, you were saying, with NHS Digital, NHSX, they want to create an open API, so it's easier for electronic patient records to integrate with these novel technologies. But it's about having UK-based data, because there are lots of companies doing stuff in South Korea, in China, in the US, in India, where populations are so much greater than ours. But actually, the NHS has its own governance and its code of conduct, and it's, well, we want UK-based data. We can't presume populations behave differently. Our pathologies are different. So our systems are different. So it's about having locally driven, data-driven stuff, and that, sadly, just takes time. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, just to tie in a couple of points that have been raised there. I mean, you talked about getting into service evaluation rather than research, and we're talking about the development of AI with big data. And I think we do have to be careful about, our use of terminology, yes, about AI versus machine learning versus interpretable machine learning. And I think we need to bear in mind, so for example, the Google flu prediction algorithms, which had the great fanfare back in 2009 until they stopped working and were quietly withdrawn in 2014. So we do have to have rigorous systems for researching and studying. And if we're looking at black box AI, I think we need to have a very heightened level of suspicion that we don't understand what it's doing, and it can go rogue on us. I think when we've got interpretable machine learning processes, certainly when it comes to things like the more woolly stuff that we deal with in general practice, I think interpretable machine learning has less risk perhaps, but I think we need to have a lot of thought on how we research, and yet it does take time, but we've learnt from innumerable drugs over the years. When you've worked in pharma, we all know the horror stories, you know, going back to thalidomide and on beyond. It looks like a good idea, it seems to be good. You look at flecainide post MI, sure, it really cut the rate of death from VF. It's just it killed a lot of people with heart failure than nobody expected. So yeah, note of caution, I think, when it comes to these things. And maybe that's why GPs are naturally cautious about this, because certainly the old gits like me have seen, we've seen flecainide come and go, we've seen osmosin come and go, we've been reprimanded for not prescribing COX-2s by bright young rheumatologists. You know, and so,
yeah, I think it's a strength, actually.
It's
because we're able to assess the risk in a fairer way.
And without wishing to be naughty, I did notice that when we stopped seeing drug reps, they targeted the nurses and got in really well.
Thank you. And on that positive note...
I am positive. Sorry.
You are. No, you are. You are. You brought great energy to the debate. Thank you so much. And thank you to our wonderful panel.